Hello, nursing station.
Calling all oncology nurses.
Are you ready to sharpen your practice, maximize your impact, and stay on the cutting edge of oncology care?
Now that you found the right place, welcome to Onc Nurse On Call. We're your hosts, Patricia Jekyll
and Stephanie Jackson. Join us on the new podcast by Oncology Nursing News as we deliver maximum value in minimal time. In each episode, we'll bring you highly focused, evidence-based clinical information, practice tips you can use today, and professional development resources to elevate your career.
Every minute counts. Let's make it count for your patients. Kristen, could you please describe your current role as an oncology nurse and tell us more about the patient population that you're currently taking care of?
Sure. I'm a nurse practitioner in medical oncology at Siteman Cancer Center at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis, Missouri. I take care of almost exclusively head and neck cancer patients and have for about 11 years now, although I have a previous background as an oncology nurse and as an oncology nurse educator. I also serve as the educator for our group of about 45 medical oncology APPs. So I try to also make sure that I stay educated, not just in head and neck, but on topics in cancer and oncology generally, so that I can identify needs and also provide or connect people up with the education that they need.
When you, as a nurse practitioner, you're managing these patients, would your treatment plan be different for the patient that's in a rural community, 50 miles from the medical center, traveling to where you work, versus the patient that's 10 miles away and, you know, you're working at an academic medical center and they have access to all the resources?
So we are a center that people come from 5 hours away. So I absolutely have those patients. So my treatment wouldn't be different, but discussions about making sure, do you have a relationship with your PCP? A lot of people haven't seen their PCP in 10, 15 years, right? Sometimes they have a local oncologist, right? Do you have a lab that you use that you can get to? Where is your nearest emergency room, right? But I've had people go, I'm not going there. I'm like, okay, but like, where would you go if you had an issue? Really reinforcing, particularly for people who live far away, about communicating with us. We have an exchange, etc. I always worry over holiday weekends. If I treat someone right before a holiday weekend, I'm always like, so here's the number, circle, 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 if any of these things happen. And making sure we know where those resources are. Sometimes even just having a primary. In the past, you know, we've had primaries who can maybe give people fluids in the community so they don't have to drive from two states away, you know, to get to us. Making sure the patients know also that that's important, right? Because I'll be like, do you have a primary? And they're like, no. And I'm like, it would be great if you could establish a relationship with a primary care provider. So trying to figure out with that patient what they might have. Also transportation, right? Do they have transportation? Is their only ride normally working during the week? So these are just things we kind of go over with patients in terms of managing scheduling, but also if they have any side effects. And I tell people, again, not very scientific, I always tell people the head tilt test, which is not scientifically proven or validated in any sense. But I tell patients, if you make this face, huh, and tilt your head, that's weird. That doesn't usually do that, huh, right? If they do that and make that face, the head tilt test, they should call as soon as they tilt their head. They should just tilt their head, pick up the phone, and give us a call, because I always tell people that's their head and their brain and their body trying to send them a message that something's off. For a lot of my patients, if I connect it to when they first were diagnosed with cancer, I'm like, did you have that kind of a moment when you first figured out you had cancer? I'm like, oh yeah, and I had this. And I'm like, so you know your body the best. You're the expert on you. So if you get that, don't ignore it. Because a lot of times people go, huh, that's weird. And then they keep going. And I kind of don't want them to keep going. I want them to call us.
Thank you, Kristen. And I'll turn it back over to Patty, and she's going to go over the nursing interventions and how you partner with the nursing staff to manage these patients, and what is the patient and family teaching that goes into, discharging them from the infusion center and keeping them safe?
You can't have a nursing podcast without nursing interventions. So here we go. What do you teach the infusion nurses in the outpatient setting? What to look for, what to monitor, and when to notify you?
So we really trust our infusion nurses. We trust their judgment. As both of you know, like we may see as an NP, I may see them for a while, and a lot of times I've built relationships with the patients, and they're often good, but they may mention something, right? If I don't ask a specific question, sometimes patients will get over to infusion like, oh, did she need to know I was coughing up blood? Yes, I did. I really did. I did not specifically ask you if you were coughing up blood, but I really did need to know that. And then the nurse will be like, hey, did you? And I'd be like, I absolutely did not know that. So that happens a lot. We'll get a call because the nurses, as they're hooking them up and they're talking to them, the patients are in kind of a different mode, and they'll mention things. And, so sometimes it's another opportunity for nurses to have that interaction with them and do an assessment. Right. The patient may not realize they're doing an assessment, but they're doing an assessment,
Sure.
and that can range from both medical things to, do you know he doesn't have a ride next time? To, do you know these things are going on? So we encourage them, we tell them we trust them because we do. We encourage them to reach out to us if they think that there's a concern. Sometimes it's fine. They're like, did you know X? I'm like, I actually did know X, right? We talked about it. He's doing this. But I'd much rather they let us know, because we may or may not have that information. And again, sometimes patients are in the clinic room. I have mostly male patients, and many of them want to chop chop. They want to get going. They want to get to the infusion center. And they'll be like, I'm like, do you have this? Nope. And because they want to get going. But then in the infusion center, they're there for a number of hours and interacting with the nurse, and they may have more of an opportunity, or may open up a little bit more about side effects. So it's that communication so that we can do an intervention, depending on what the symptom is, depending on what's happening with that patient.
And a very different role in the inpatient setting. And I have to say, 15 years ago, immunotherapy, there was many very sick patients that ended up on the inpatient setting, blood sugars of 600, colitis where the diarrhea was unstoppable. And we weren't as good as managing patients early on and assessing them. And I think it's improved. I don't know the percentage of your patients that actually get admitted because of side effects. But what words of wisdom would you tell the inpatient nurses when they're taking care of patients that are having side effects from immunotherapy?
Again, steroids. Our joke in the early days of immunotherapy was just say, just get it tattooed inside your arm. Please give me steroids. Because I had people who went to local EDs, and not that the care wasn't good, it's just they weren't aware of immunotherapy and they had diarrhea, and then they weren't treated with steroids. They were tested for C. diff and ovine parasites and everything else. And by the time they got to our medical center, the colitis was to such a degree that it re required IV medications. We have a number of them now to help calm that down, and not always successfully. So just, let people know that you're on immunotherapy. Let us know, even if you're seen locally. And then when people are inpatient, to communicate with their nurses, if they think things are getting worse or better, to let the nurses know, and for nurses to sort of evaluate. Sometimes it's not the things that patients tell us, sometimes it's the things that we observe, right? Maybe the patient hasn't mentioned diarrhea, but you're in there, and they're every time you go in, they're in the restroom, right? Maybe, you go in there and they're itching like crazy, or they're like, it's so weird, I got this new rash, whatever, right? Obviously things like jaundice, although inpatient, we're going to be, looking for that, new pains, new anything like that. But just again, we trust our nurses, we trust our inpatient nurses. But because it works so differently, and because people call everything chemotherapy, right? So sometimes systemic therapy, immunotherapy, it's all called chemotherapy. And even immunotherapies have very different potential side effects, as do all of these targeted therapies, to have them reach out if they have a new medication. I mean, I've definitely had a patient in the hospital, first in humans. Excellent, right? There's no way. I mean, I'm learning on the fly, right? And this is the first person who's got it in the world, right? And they're like, they're on the horn. And then we're talking and communicating. Well, this is the class of drug. This is what you might want to look for, et cetera. But, you know, nurses at the bedside and nurses in the infusion center, they are so key. They're often the first line of defense or offense, depending on what's going on, in terms of letting us know their observational skills, their assessment, and their own interventions, as well as helping us craft and figure out what our plan would be for interventions and maybe even possible treatment.
Great. Great answer. Thank you. Last question, and I think you've already covered it beautifully in your presentation, is about patient education. And I love the head tilt. I'm going to remember that when I have the opportunity to teach nurses about patient education. Is there anything you would like to add for nurses to be aware of for patient education?
So don't assume health literacy. So, and I have an anecdote. I had a patient I took care of for years. I printed out so many things for this gentleman. And after we had built a relationship, one day I kind of realized, and he can't read. And we had a long talk, and he could not read. It was a terribly sad story that I will not go into here. Super smart guy, very successful in what he chose to do. But just navigating the medical center was like nightmarish for him, right? And, you know, he really, people would be like, do you check my chart? He'd be like, sure, no, right? And so he was terrified before he came in for each scan because he hadn't read it, because he couldn't really read it. CDC has a plain language thesaurus, which is like from 2006, but is hugely useful, where it puts medical terms in like fifth grade terms. So if you're like, how would I say edema, right? And it's a PDF and you can download it. So if you're making materials, I always recommend that to people as a resource. If you're talking to someone, yes, you want to meet them where they are. But even people who are very highly educated, so someone can be a physician, someone could have a PhD, but they don't know this area of cancer, or and they are in it. They are not outside of it. So sometimes people will make assumptions that they know this or that. So educate the person in front of you, right? Try to not make assumptions. Remember about health literacy, make it as clear as possible. That's why I use my stories and analogies. If people want more information, you both know I'm a huge nerd. I am totally willing to go into more detail. Also, remember that people only absorb about maybe to 20 to 30% of what you say in any one visit, time after time, research shows. And so you're going to have to re-educate. So, and reinforce. And I really try, I ask a million questions, yes, but I'll try to sum up at the end of my visit, and nurses, you know, before they leave a patient room or at the end of the infusion, like the three most important things for the patient in front of me. Okay, so you're going to be coming back. Don't forget that you're going to have a PET scan before. It's really important to start these steroids tomorrow. See what it says on the bottle. If you overload people with information, and then, but then always give them a if you have questions, call us. Here's how you reach us. Right. If you
Okay.
overload people with information, they absorb almost nothing. Right. So you want to focus on what are the most important things that they need to know today, but also give them an avenue to contact somebody with the answers if other questions come up or other issues come up.
That's it for this episode of Onc Nurse on Call.
We hope the insights we brought you today have given you a few immediate takeaways to enhance your practice and elevate your patient care this week.
You can find the detailed notes, the current evidence that we discussed, and the resources for professional development at www.onknursingnews.com.
If you found value in this episode, hit subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts and leave us a review. It helps other oncology nurses find our show.
Join us again in 2 weeks for another power-packed, evidence-based episode.
Until then, keep leading with excellence.